The social organization of the city was laid out in such a way that at the core of the city were the people of the highest caste rankings, and at the periphery, or as you went out in concentric circles, you came into lower and lower caste communities, so that arrayed around the royal family and the priestly castes would have been a rough concentric circle or ring of higher caste merchants, Newar Shrestas mainly. Beyond them, a ring of Newar artisan castes, oil pressers, potters, and what have you. Beyond them, closer to the walls, a large population of Newar farmers. And in fact, it was a surprise to me when I learned that as recently as the 1950s and 60s, more than half of the population of Kathmandu City were engaged in day-to-day farming. They would every morning leave their houses, walk out into their fields, and they engage in a very intensive, small-scale, almost intensive gardening. The food was abundant, but cash was in short supply. So with that little bit of an introduction, I just want to say that what I'd like to do in this talk today is to look at how street-level or budget tourism developed in the context of this social and ritual organization in the old city of Kathmandu, starting from around the 1960s onward. And just by way of contextualization, this is part of a larger project. This talk is extracted from a larger project on the history of tourism, roughly 1950 to 1980. There was also, at this time, an elite or high-end or luxury tourism going on, in fact, that had begun earlier than this in the 1950s and continued through this period, but that's another story. What I want to talk about more today is how cultural factors like caste, purity and pollution, the use of public and private space, how these things figured into the story of how tourists got integrated into the local scene. So this is a story of how ideas of ritual purity, things that got lived out in the form of the caste-based social order, but also in ideas of the proper usage of space, how those ideas got transformed as what began as a trickle of foreign tourists, youthful tourists in the early to mid-60s, by around 1970 to 1972, turned into a huge flood of basically hippie travelers. It was these hippie tourists that not only brought new ideas, but probably more importantly, they simply brought money. And it was tourists and tourism money that changed the meanings and possibilities of social relations in the cities, and also the meanings and possibilities of how to use space in the city. And it's these are some of the issues that I'd like to talk about. Yeah, all right. It's basically cut off again. But I want to start by describing the area of the city of Kathmandu that first saw a concentration of these budget class tourist operations, and this is an area known as Maruhiti. The Maruhiti is an area that the old city wall would have gone about right here. And just beyond Maruhiti is an area of untouchables, in particular the Newar butcher castes, the Kasais. And when I was talking about the spatial organization of the caste groups, I didn't get to the point where I should have mentioned that just beyond the old city walls, literally on the outside of the walls, were the places of the untouchables, the people at the bottom of the social order. These were people like butchers and animal skinners, who lived here to the west of the city, and to the south, communities of sweepers, portes in Newari, sweeper castes, people whose job it was to basically manage solid waste in the city traditionally. Now, the fact that the first tourist areas developed in here, the first tourist clusters developed in this area is not a coincidence, because these are low-caste areas. Both untouchables and Newar farming castes live in this community. And so I want to start this story by introducing one fellow. This man is named Bishnu Doj Shahi. He was born in around 1929, and he's one of the pioneers of tourism, budget tourism in Nepal. Bishnu Shahi is from the untouchable Kasai butcher caste, and as a young man, he had almost no access to formal education, and yet he managed to teach himself basic literacy in Nepali and even acquired an English book, he said, and managed to learn a few phrases in English so that when foreigners showed up in Kathmandu in the early 1950s after the state of Nepal opened, he was one of the first people to begin to work for foreigners. What's interesting about the arrival of foreigners is that in the eyes of Nepalis, foreigners were themselves untouchables. Because they were non-Hindus, they were outside, they were technically heathens or barbarians, to use the translation of a local term. And to make matters worse, if they were American hamburger eaters, they were guilty of cow consumption, which is a complete abomination in the Hindu worldview. What this meant was that most high caste Nepalis were quite willing to work with foreigners in official settings, in business contacts, but when it came to things like opening their home to foreigners, that was taboo. When it came to things like sharing meals with foreigners, that was taboo. And of course, unthinkable for a high caste person would have been working in the home of one of these foreigners. And yet, when foreigners arrived, so for example, early diplomatic and aid personnel, they needed to set up households. Many of them brought their families, and they needed domestic servants. No one would work for them. Initially, they brought in Indian Christians to work for them, but eventually, a few Nepalis started working for these foreigners, and Bishnu Shahi was one of them. In the early 1950s, in fact, he became the cook for a man named Paul Rose, who was the head of the first USAID delegation in Kathmandu. He worked for various Americans for most of the decade of the 50s, and during that time became an excellent cook and an excellent baker, and he also learned basic English skills. And yet, eventually, he got tired of the low wages that the Americans were paying him. He said that he only got paid 200 rupees a month, which is maybe about $5 a month. And he decided he could make more money on his own. So in the early 1960s, Bishnu Shahi opened a tiny tea shop down here in the Kasai neighborhood along the Bishnumati River. This is an area where the Kasais, the untouchable butcher caste, were basically squatting on public land. They owned no property, but they had built a kind of ramshackle community down here along the river. Now, whether by design or by chance, Bishnu's tea shop was opened about 100 yards from the bridge, which serves as a kind of bottleneck that funnels anybody who wants to walk from the old city center here out across the countryside to the Swayambhu Temple. This is a popular tourist destination. And so what it meant was that his shop was located right at a point where just about every tourist eventually walked past it. And this proved to be very good for business, because not only could foreigners drop in for a cup of tea, but Bishnu actually spoke some English, which made him one of a tiny number of even educated Nepalis who, at this time, almost no one would have spoken English, but he had acquired some. And so you could sit there and chat with a local, which is something that many people wished to do. Bishnu quickly acquired a large group of foreign friends, and at one point around the mid-60s, when some of them learned that he could bake pies, they said, "Well, why don't you bake us a pie?" And he said, "Well, I'd love to, but I don't have an oven." So they said, "We'll buy you an oven." They bought him an oven, which was basically a little tin box that you put on top of a gas burner, which would be almost impossible for anyone else to bake in. But this is what he had learned. He had mastered the art of baking in a tin box. And he began producing delicious fruit pies. And what he discovered was that almost instantly there was an enormous demand. He could not make pies fast enough. By early 1967, he had saved enough money to purchase a larger oven, which is still sitting in his storeroom, which he could bake 4 to 6 pies at once, and he decided to go into the pie business. A friend of his, who he only remembers as a Californian named Chris, who I haven't been able to track down, came up with a name for his shop, which was Bishnu's Chai and Pie. Chai, we're all familiar with now, even though that's not actually how Nepalis pronounce it, but it rhymes with pie, so it worked. And Bishnu was in business. Now, so pretty soon he had lines of young foreigners standing outside his shop waiting to get in, and some people referred to the area as Pie Alley because of the pie shop. Others referred to it as Pig Alley, less happily, but also accurately, because this was an area that the Kasais were one of the few Nepali groups that keeps and eats pigs. This is what also makes them untouchables. But there were a lot of pigs roaming around the area. But Bishnu's Chai and Pie became an institution. And I want to read a passage from a memoir written by an American who visited Kathmandu in the early 1970s. And he's describing a walk that he took from out here in Swayambhu back into the old city to where he was staying. And this is what he's just come across the bridge here on the river, and this is what he has to say. From there, a path known as Pig Alley wound its way up toward the center of town. I walked past some dilapidated buildings and saw a bunch of naked kids running around with filthy faces and snotty noses. Nearby, a half dozen pigs lolled around in a muddy stink hole along the cobblestone path. I nearly gagged from the smell of their filth, but that was nothing compared to the odors wafting out of an open latrine right next to the path. There was shit everywhere. Along the path, in the little crevices of the cobblestones, and everywhere in between, it was the filthiest, foulest, smelliest street in the world, and right there in the middle of it, right where the pig, buffalo, and human excrement all mixed together into a big souffle of shit, right there was Bishnu's Chai and Pie. I pulled open a creaky screen door and stepped into a small, dark space. I'd been trying not to breathe, but now I inhaled and was amazed by the sweet scent of cooked fruit and fresh-baked dough. When I glanced over to see a counter filled with apple pies, lemon meringue pies, chocolate mousse pies, I was quite certain I'd lost my mind. Apple pie, I whispered to the man behind the counter. Will that be plain or with whipped cream? Yes, whipped cream, I laughed. That's when I heard a thump at the door. I looked over to see one of the pigs trying to nuzzle its way in. Unquote. So, Bishnu was an immediate success, and his success soon spawned dozens of imitators around the city. And in fact, Kathmandu is still known for its pie shops and cake shops. Not only was this the first pie shop in Kathmandu, it was arguably the first in Asia and maybe the first, you know, east of Istanbul, I don't know. But it was the beginning of a trend that made Kathmandu a famous destination for comfort food. For people on the hippie trail, going overland from Europe or from Southeast Asia, people that hadn't eaten familiar foods for months and maybe were, you know, half dead of starvation, would arrive in Kathmandu and snarf down pies and cakes at places like Bishnu's. By the early 70s, Kathmandu had become famous for its food. It was known as the Alice's Restaurant of the East, a place where you could get anything you want, by way of food and other things, by the way. And you had specialty restaurants in everything from Swiss to Mexican to Thai, you name it, you could get it in Kathmandu. All right, so Bishnu's business is one of the early food establishments. This image here is the current condition of the first budget-level hotel in Kathmandu, a place known as the Camp Hotel. It has, for the last 20 years, ceased to be a hotel, but this is where it used to be. The Camp Hotel was located just up the street from Bishnu's Chai and Pie, and it opened at about the exact same time. In around 1965, an American Peace Corps volunteer who was assigned to the Kathmandu to work with the Ministry of Education on curriculum development needed a place to stay, and there were on his stipend, he couldn't afford to stay at one of the real hotels, so he began looking for a family that would take him in. And through the grapevine, he learned of a Newar farming family, the Maharjans, that would rent a room to him. Before long, his friends from the Peace Corps who were in town needing a place to stay for a few days or a week or two began staying with him and renting space. And, you know, by around the middle of 1966, the Maharjan family discovered that they were operating a de facto guest house. And in early 1967, at about the same time that Bishnu put up his chai and pai sign, the Maharjan family put out a sign in front of their house saying Camp Hotel. And it immediately became, well, it became the first kind of signboarded place for street-level budget tourists. And it quickly attracted attention, including in the fall of 1967, a reporter from the New Yorker magazine who came and described the camp restaurant. The camp restaurant, quote, serves American-style breakfasts of pancakes and eggs in its restaurant, as well as Tibetan food, and there's usually classical music playing from the hi-fi set. The atmosphere is more like a cafe in Greenwich Village than anything else, and the clientele looks and talks as if it might have been transported bodily from the village. And in fact, there was kind of a relocation of the countercultural scene that was beginning to happen in Kathmandu at this time. Part of the ethos of the camp hotel and camp restaurant was the chillum that was passed around. Chillum is a South Asian clay pipe used to smoke ganja or hashish. And the proprietors thoughtfully provided a bottomless supply of these products to their patrons. And this also added to the appeal of the camp restaurant. The restaurant, interestingly, started somewhat after the hotel started. And it was started by an Indian fellow named Ravi Chawla. Apparently, Ravi Chawla was somebody that had stayed at the camp hotel in early 1967, decided that he really liked the city and wanted to stay on, and he offered to open and manage a hotel for the Maharjan family, which he did. And the hotel became, the restaurant and the hotel became very popular, and Ravi Chawla himself became kind of an iconic figure along the hippie trail. People knew about him and sought him out when they got to Kathmandu. He was part of the attraction. He was apparently a very charismatic character. All right, so it was places like the Camp Hotel and the Bishnu's Chai and Pai that were kind of the nucleus of a developing tourism business in this area of Maruhiti or Pig Alley. And within months, literally, there were dozens of other copycat establishments so that, you know, when the Camp Hotel was full, people would walk down the street knocking on doors saying, excuse me, could I, you know, using sign language, could I sleep on your floor? And they would pull out money and the people would say, yeah, sure. And eventually people began putting up their own signboards and Maruhiti became the first budget tourist area in the city. Here I should mention briefly a bit about the economics of these neighborhoods, or a neighborhood like Maruhiti. As I said, this was an area made up mainly of low castes, farmers, and untouchables. These are people that had been pretty much frozen out of the cash economy. At least for the farmers, these are people that were very food secure. They had plenty of food because they raised it themselves, but because so much food was being produced in the valley, it had very little economic value. They could work for a week and make only a trifling amount of cash, and they needed money to purchase things that they couldn't produce themselves, like salt and clothing, tea, what have you. And so this was an area that was desperately in search of cash. Well, into that walk these young tourists, and these tourists are people that are desperately trying to save money. And yet, by paying the equivalent of a nickel or a dime a day to stay in somebody's house, for a Nepali who was cash desperate, that was real money. And so both sides felt as though they had just struck it rich. The foreigners could stay for months on almost nothing, and the locals were making money for the first time in their lives. The other interesting thing that happened is relating to the use of domestic space. In traditional Hindu cosmology, in addition to an idea of purity and pollution in terms of the caste system that many people are familiar with, there's also buildings themselves also have ritually pure and impure areas. And in particular, the lower part of the building, the lower you are in the building, the more impure it is. And the higher you get in the building, the more pure it gets. So this is why traditionally, and in fact even till even today, most people have their kitchens and their religious shrines on the top floor, and this is where they eat their meals. That's because it's the most ritually pure. And as you go progressively down, it gets more and more impure until you get to the street level space, which traditionally was thought to be very, very filthy. It was a place where no one would have dreamed of eating or sleeping, for example. It was a place where you stored your animals, your garbage, what have you. And yet, into that worldview walk these foreigners who were willing to pay money to sleep on the floor next to the buffalo. And somehow, locals were amazed that these people didn't seem to care. They didn't care that this was the most ritually impure, not to mention other terms, impure spaces. And even more to their amazement, these foreigners would eat food on the ground floor. They didn't want to go upstairs. Well, they might want to, but they were willing to eat food on the ground floor. This is a total transformation of the logic of domestic space in the old city. And yet, it was a lesson that was quickly learned, because suddenly these ground floor spaces went from being virtually worthless in the old ritual economy to being absolutely cash generating spaces in this new tourist economy. You could open a restaurant, a shop, a pie shop, a souvenir shop on your ground floor and make a lot of money. And so, one of the things that's happening here is the meaning of spaces in domestic homes was beginning to change. And of course, so also was beginning to change people's understanding of what tourism meant. By the late 1960s, more and more people in the city were beginning to realize that foreigners were showing up in greater numbers, they had money, and why should only these farmers and untouchables down here get all the money? Other people wanted it as well. And so by the late 60s, you begin to see a shift, here's my pointer, into a new area just off the old Imperial Center of Durbar Square. This is an area that was traditionally home of the Newar merchant castes. These are the people that had been involved in the long-distance trade between Calcutta and Lhasa, with Kathmandu as an important entrepot on this overland trade route. In the early 1950s, when the Chinese invaded Tibet, things became more and more difficult for Newar merchants who were located in Lhasa and Shigatse and the other cities. And by the mid-50s, more and more of these Newar merchants, even though they'd been property owners in Tibet for centuries, began cashing in on their properties there and reinvesting their capital in other new businesses because the Tibet trade was being shut off. Some of them invested in stuff like trucks and transport. Others set up small manufacturing businesses, and still others went into tourism. By the late 60s, it was becoming apparent that there was money to be made in tourism. And one of the first people to do that was a Shrestha family who owned a house right about at the tip of this arrow, along a street between Basantapur and Jochitol. They decided to transform their family house into a lodge. which they called the Oriental Lodge. And so in 1968, in the summer of 1968, they started remodeling their house. And about that time, our friend from down here in Marahiti, Ravi Chawla, the guy that was managing the camp restaurant, approached Mr. Shrestha and said, look, if you rent this place to me, I'll manage it for you. I'll give you money. You don't have to do anything. I'll run the place for you. And the Shrestas thought about it for a while, and ultimately they said no. But apparently, Ravi Chawla was having some difficulties with the Maharajan family and wanted his own place. So after being turned down by the Shrestas, Ravi Chawla moved a couple doors down and managed to rent the ground floor from another family and turned it into a new restaurant. So almost simultaneously in the spring of 1969, a major new lodge, the Oriental Lodge, opens up along with a new restaurant on this street, the first restaurant in this area, known as Ravi's Spot. And because Ravi was already quite famous in tourism circles, a lot of people followed him to this area, and that began a shift in the center of gravity toward a new part of town. Now, it's important to recognize that the timing was perfect for these two businesses, because the spring of 1969 saw a sudden mass influx of young foreigners into Kathmandu. And this was no coincidence. Through the 1968 had been an important year for the Western youth counterculture. Some of you might have lived through those years and might remember. This is the year that began with a great deal of optimism on the part of the youth radical counterculture, the hope that things could be changed for the better, that the Vietnam War might be brought to an end. Lyndon Johnson announced that he wouldn't be running for re-election. Bobby Kennedy was running in the primaries for the Democratic nomination. He had promised to end the war. The civil rights movement was churning along. And then in April and May of 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. That summer, there was violence at the Chicago DNC. And the final straw was in November, the election of Richard Nixon. There was enormous elation crashed into enormous disappointment, and literally hundreds of thousands of American and European youth radicals decided to opt out, and many of them hit the road. Hundreds of thousands hit the road heading to all over the world, but many of them headed to Asia. And starting in the spring of 1969, locals told me about how every day, wave after wave of foreigners would be showing up on the streets, and the whole city began, itself felt like it filled up with hippies. Well, there was an enormous demand for lodging and food, and many of those people ended up being directed to this area. I could say a lot more about this, but one of the things that happened in this context was that young Nepalis began to establish significant relationships with young foreigners, and one of the first people that came to be identified as a Nepali hippie was a man named Trilochan Shrestha, who I don't have a picture of, but in the late 60s, he began hanging out with the foreigners at Swayambhu and at other religious sites, and he was from a rich Shrestha family that owned property along this street. And in 1971, he, with a Spanish friend, opened a restaurant on the street that was known as the Yin and Yang Restaurant. And it specialized in Chinese food and also hashish. And I should point out that in Nepal, cannabis products were not just legal, but literally government-sanctioned. The government had a monopoly on the cannabis trade, and so you would purchase your cannabis from government-regulated shops. Obviously part of the appeal of the city, too, for these young foreigners. But Trilochan Shrestha started the Yin and Yang, and when he was setting up the restaurant, he told me how he had to have a signboard made to hang outside the restaurant. And so he wrote Yin and Yang, And then the custom then and now was to write the location on the sideboard. And he told me how he looked around and he saw the streets were full of freaks. And he said, man, this is Freak Street. And so he decided to write Freak Street on his signboard. And from that point on, this space was christened Freak Street. And if you can look closely enough, it's actually in English written there, Freak Street, on this Nepali map. You'll notice also that almost no other street in the old city has a name, and that's because in the old city, streets do not have names. The traditional Nepali urban space was thought of not in terms of linear streets with names, but rather named crossroads. And so the street that became Freak Street would have, for locals, been referred to not as a street, but rather the area between Jochetol and Basantapur. And so by naming the street, what I'm getting at is he didn't have to rename it because it simply didn't have a name. He was imposing a kind of Western understanding of spatial reckoning onto this space. And it was one of the few, it remains one of the few spaces in the old city with a named street. Now, elsewhere in Kathmandu, many of the main streets have names, but this is one of the first and only in the old city. Okay, here, I don't have any pictures of the 70s because the hippies didn't have cameras, apparently. But this is a painting done by a local artist in the 1970s. You can see the Oriental Hotel over here, the Hungry Eye restaurant, all kinds of popular places. And at the end of the street is part of the old royal palace. This is an image of one of the popular destinations on Freak Street, the Eden Hashish Center. This was owned by a Nepali man named D.D. Sharma, who became one of the most wealthy men in Nepal. It was a rags-to-riches story. He started out peddling bottled ketchup on the streets and eventually rented a space and got into the hash trade and became a millionaire, by Western standards, a filthy rich character. And the Eden Hashish Center was a very popular location, which I won't go into great detail, but it represents, as I mentioned, one of the prime attractions for foreigners, especially hippie foreigners, in Kathmandu. Yet in 1973, in July of 1973, the Nepali government issued a proclamation banning the sale or purchase of cannabis. And from that point on, even though there was a vigorous black market in these products, it was officially illegal, and people like D.D. Sharma suffered as a result of it. The story of why cannabis was banned is complicated, but it has everything to do with pressure from the United States. The Nixon administration launched its war on drugs very early in the first Nixon administration. And it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that the war on drugs was also a war on the youth counterculture. And they were willing to take this war to any frontier, including abroad. And Nepal, as one of the last places on earth where cannabis was legal, was an important symbolic place for the Nixon administration. President Nixon actually sent Spiro Agnew to Nepal in 1971 to try to convince the king to ban it. Finally, though, in 1973, the King Birendra did decide to ban cannabis, not so much because of pressure from the United States, according to his aides that I talked to, as much as the fact that Kathmandu was beginning by that time to get a somewhat negative reputation as a hippie, drug-infested hangout. Now, here, I think it's really important to remember that, you know, around 1970, hippies would have represented for many people a kind of idealistic flower child kind of image, nothing particularly threatening, I think it's safe to say. Yet by 1975, hippies had become kind of dirty bones. They were seen as being unsightly. And what this represents is a kind of global shift, a global reaction against what were seen in the 70s as the excesses of the youth counterculture in the 60s, and a kind of backlash against that. And so the decision to delegalize cannabis was part of this global trend against, this turning against the youth counterculture. And Freak Street was literally a kind of icon of that culture. And it's from 1973 on that you begin to see a decline in the fortunes of the Freak Street area. Contributing to that decline was the 1973 oil embargo. That put a dent in tourists, but it also signaled the death knell for the happy times of the 60s, where money was cheap, where you could work for a few months and spend the rest of the year off on the hippie trail. Suddenly, that time was over, and it was a time of scarce jobs, of careers, of goal orientation. This is the point at which we go from hippies to yuppies, if I may use those terms. And along with that, the whole counterculture ethos of Freak Street began to look very tarnished and tattered. I have some very poignant comments from local hotel owners on Freak Street who talked about how the same hotel in the early 70s seemed to be everything that the tourists ever wanted, but by the mid-70s, suddenly they were all complaining, and nothing had changed that the locals could tell. Really, the only thing that had changed were the tourists themselves. And the people, the hippies who had come looking for an authentic local experience and who were eager to spend as little as possible and willing to stay anywhere they could throw a sleeping bag, those days were over. In the mid-70s, as tourism recovered in greater and greater numbers, the new tourists that came were people on a tighter schedule. They had money. They were willing to spend it. But they wanted value for their money. They wanted value for their dollars or yen or francs. So some of these local Freak Street merchants tried to remodel their facilities, but they found it was almost impossible. How can you put central plumbing in a house that's 5 centuries old? How can you put attached baths in these places? It was impossible. And so we see this gradual decline in the Freak Street market. However, as Freak Street is declining, we see the emergence of a third, and today the most, by far the largest and most vibrant budget tourism area in the city, a place known as Tamel. Now, in the early 1970s, Tamel was literally on the outskirts of town. It was an area. People describe it as kind of a kind of brushy wasteland. There were some cow pastures out there, some scraggly forests, a few rundown palaces of lesser nobles who are down on their luck. It's the kind of place where locals thought it was haunted. This is a place where locals said that they would never go there at night because there were ghosts and witches floating around. But for foreigners, or at least a certain kind of foreigner, they liked it. It was quiet. It was out in the countryside. There was fresh air. It wasn't all dark and cramped like the old city. And it was here that you see the first of a new kind of hotel, a budget hotel, opening up. And so I want to tell the story of the man who opened that hotel. His name is Karna Shakya. Karna Shakya came from a Newar Buddhist family that actually has the same surname as Gautama Buddha. But as a young man, he had been educated in Kathmandu, but then he went abroad to Australia and got a master's in environmental conservation. And he returned to Kathmandu in around 1970. He got a job with the Nepali government, but his salary was so low that he could barely support himself, let alone a family. And he began to think about what he could do to make ends meet. And he thought about his experiences in Australia and also traveling around in Southeast Asia. And he thought about some of the student guest houses that, that he had stayed at as when he was a student. And he thought, you know, that's what we need in Kathmandu. So he took some money from his family. He got his family to invest with him. He bought a ramshackle old palace out there in Tamil that was falling down. He converted the rooms such that each room had an attached bath and running hot water and a shower. And he opened a hotel. It was called the Kathmandu Guest House. And he charged more money than in Freak Street. He charged probably three or four times as much money. But so what that meant was that instead of spending 50 cents a night, you would be spending $2 a night. And what he found was that there were plenty of people that were willing to pay that much money for a quiet, clean place with a shower, rather than, you know, a rat-infested place that was built for Nepalis where you had to walk like this because the foreigners were too tall, where you bathed out in a tap in the courtyard, that kind of thing. So in 1971, he opened the Kathmandu Guest House, and in an interview I did with Karna Shakya, he told me about his attitude toward hippies, and this is interesting. This is what he told me. I gave strict instructions to my staff. There was a definition of hippies in my hotel. The one who doesn't come with shoes, the one who shows his buttocks. You know, sometimes we see jeans with holes in them. The man with no respect for his body cannot be respected by other people. And the man who never washes, who has weird kinds of things, and he's going like this with his hands, indicating the kind of filthy, matted hair that the hippies had. And he said, so that kind of three characters, we never put them up from the beginning. So no hippies allowed. And the gatekeeper was told to keep anyone who met those criteria out of the place. What Karna Shakya just had intuited was that there was a demand for a place like this, and he was right. Very quickly, he was perpetually full. He bought more space. He renovated more rooms. It became a large establishment. It's still a large establishment in the city, out there in Tamil. And also, notably, within literally a matter of months, you saw other businesses springing up around the gates of the hotel. Restaurants, souvenir shops, other hotels, travel agents, trekking places, you name it. Within by around 1975 to 1980, within that period, Tamil became an enormous, and it is to this day, an enormous cluster of tourist facilities. And what's crucial to note about Tamil is that it's unlike these earlier two locations that had tourism, because for the first time, it wasn't a matter of renovating or reusing existing structures and trying to adapt them to the tourist trade. Now you have new construction, well, except with the exception, actually, of Kathmandu Guest House, although the newer wings were new construction of that as well. But for the first time, what you had was a tourism infrastructure that was being based on international standards. It was often run by Nepalis like Karna Shakya, who had themselves been outside of the country, who understood what international standards were, understood the places where their guests were coming from, literally where they were coming from, and understood what these people, what they wanted. And so for the first time, you get a tourist district emerging in the city that is no longer what I think of as a local space with tourists in it, but rather it becomes for the first time a tourist space in which locals might come and go. But it's primarily, well, it is exclusively built for tourists and to tourist standards. This, I think, is what Dennis Judd and others have called something like a tourist bubble. In other words, it's a space that's specifically designed as a zone of kind of transnational foreignness that's plunked down in a local space, but it's a space into which tourists can retreat back into a kind of familiar comfort zone and then make forays out into the exotic, local universe. And it's this space that now, I mean, today, Tamil literally covers several square miles. It's just an incredible sprawl of bars and hotels of every variety. There are even special neighborhoods that specialize in, you know, this place is for Israeli tourists and this place is for French. And, you know, it's, they've got every market niche down. All right, well, I'm going to begin wrapping up. But let me just say that what I've been trying to talk about here is how these foreigners, this arrival of a sudden flood of young foreigners in the late 60s and early 70s, people who were themselves untouchables, how that disrupted the traditional caste-based social order, and how people that had been frozen out of the local money economy were able to literally cash in on tourists in significant ways, ways that, that certainly didn't abolish the relevancy of caste, but really for the first time gave people at the bottom of the social order the chance to operate in a larger economy. Also, I've been trying to describe some of the ways that tourism transformed the meaning and experience of space. I talked about how tourism literally turned local understandings of value on their head in how the ground floors and street frontage of these traditional homes went from being ritually impure and economically worthless to being very prime commercial real estate. Similarly, parts of the city that were at one time marginal, places like the untouchable communities, but also Tamil, places that were either ritually defiled or thought to be haunted, turned out to be, you know, real money-making, cash-producing zones when it came to dealing with foreigners who seemed to not only have no trouble interacting with untouchables, to the surprise of many local Nepalese, but also didn't seem to be at all concerned about ghosts and evil spirits. With a nod to Max Weber, we could say that tourism brought about an almost literal disenchantment of the city. Spaces that had been enchanted were no longer, as a system of ritual meaning, ritual value gets transformed gradually by a new calculus of economic value. And just in conclusion, there was an old man I talked to who told me about how, as a boy, growing up in the old city, he lived right around down here in the farmer caste area. He said that as a boy, nobody in his neighborhood would go out at night because they were afraid of getting attacked by ghosts or evil spirits. But, he said, in a quote, after the tourists came, the ghosts went away. Now we Nepalis spend so much time out at night that we are the ones that have become like ghosts. Unquote. Thank you.